Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 1:32 p.m. We're in Belch, Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today's Monday, March 25th, 2024. Members present are Senator Merrick, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Chair Bjorkman. Senator Greg Jackson is excused on state business today, and Senator Bishop will be joining us shortly. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I'd like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Mary Gwen Kawakami, and our LAO moderator, Joseph Giesbrecht. Today, we have three items on our agenda. First up is Senate Bill 203, Business License Fees, followed by Senate Bill 200, TRS Contribution Rate, PERS, Social Security, or SBS. Followed by Senate Bill 153, Overtime Pay Exemption. First up is Senate Bill 203. With us to make a brief presentation on the bill, we have Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Michaela Fowler. Ms. Fowler, please join us at the table. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you. For the record, Michaela Fowler, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Commissioner Sandy sends her regrets that she's not able to be here today. She is en route to Juneau and will be in front of the committee if it pleases you for future hearings on this legislation. I'm going to provide a very brief sort of overview of how this bill came to be, and then I'll hand it over to Director Rob to go over the details of the legislation. So, over the course of the last year and a half, the department has been having conversations with the business community about interest in how the state can do more to promote industries that don't have a promotional entity, such as the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, or the Alaska Tourism Marketing Institute, ATIA, and Industry Association. And we were looking for opportunities that the state might be able to do more of that. Last session, the legislature very generously provided $5 million in the capital budget for the department to start doing some of that work. We recognize that asking for a UGF appropriation on an ongoing basis is a challenging thing in today's economy. And so we were looking for opportunities to have a small fee increase that would impact the population that will also benefit from that activity. And the business license fees for the state have been set at $50 a year for since 2008. Prior to 2008, they were actually $100 a year. This legislation does propose going back to that $100 number that was the 2008 figure. And with the intent, that is with the intent that, that the legislature may choose to appropriate those additional funds to support business marketing. Now, in speaking to this, I think it's important to give a sort of a brief overview of where we're at with the $5 million that you gave us last year. The department, again, we're very appreciative of that effort. We have currently received, we have a contract with the Alaska State Chamber to begin some of the polling for identifying where Alaskans would like to see us really investing that money and how we can both do sort of appropriate market research and appropriate support to industries that are thriving in our economy or our emerging industries. In prior years, it's been some time now, but in prior administrations, we saw promotional activities around peonies that was really of great interest to the legislature at the time, and we saw that that really helped grow the peony industry in Alaska. There was a suite of promotional activities around different emerging industries. During that sort of 2000 and I believe it was 2006 to 2010 timeline. And so those are sort of where we're looking for what the greatest interest is going forward. With that, I'm happy to take questions or hand things over to Director Rob.
Are there any questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Seeing none, Director Robb. Please put yourself on the record and welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Deputy Commissioner Fowler got us off to a great start talking about this bill, which does in turn business license fees to the level they were at in 2008. So this would return that fee for a regular business license from $50 to $100. This would maintain the 50% discount that currently exists and will continue to exist for disabled veterans or those 65 or older who have a sole proprietorship, so that their fee would go from $25 to $50. And then it increases the tobacco endorsement from $100 to $200 per renewal. So this increase is a way to increase the state's revenue without heavily impacting any one profession or industry. Obviously, the impact for any single business would be a $50 increase. The estimated revenue that would be generated by this is $2.7 million. This would not put Alaska out of line with what other states charge for business licenses. Those fees range anywhere from $20 in a few states to $500 in some states. So there's really a very wide range. And as Deputy Commissioner Fowler talked about, the intent with using some of these funds to help promote those folks that we're asking to provide that funding. Just to remind you who this would impact, so you can see the statute on the slide that outlines who needs to purchase a business license, and basically that's anyone who's doing business in the state of Alaska as a for-profit or nonprofit. Within the state, there are a few exceptions, and we do have those outlined on the following slide. And then you can see that an endorsement is required for anyone who wants to sell tobacco products, products containing nicotine, or sell electronic smoking devices. So here on slide 5, you can see who is exempt from requiring a business license. And it's fisheries businesses, the sale of liquor is exempt, insurance businesses, mining businesses, banks and credit unions, and then those one-time efforts. And so this is if you're holding a garage sale, you have a lemonade stand. But it also gives an opportunity for people who, you know, maybe thinking of starting a business, perhaps selling some product that they manufacture. You know, maybe you make knitted socks and you don't know what the market for those may be. And so you could go to a bazaar and see if there's an interest in that product before you needed to purchase a business license.
Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, thank you, Director, for being here. I was wondering if you could give us sort of the policy rationale why insurance businesses and then sort of all financial businesses are exempt from these license fees. Do they have a separate set of fees that they have to pay instead?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, that's correct. So insurance businesses are licensed through the Division of Insurance. Also within the Department of Commerce, and as are the sale of alcohol, licenses are required from AMCO, which is also part of Commerce.
And the banks and the credit unions?
Again, through the chair, Senator Dunbar, banks and credit unions are licensed by banking and securities, again, part of Commerce, but a business license is not required. For a bank, you have to get a license from banking and securities.
Okay, and those presumably are not free?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, no.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question. With on slide 5, with all these businesses that are not required to have a license, many times financial institutions require a business owner who is on that list to present some kind of license to start a banking account or do other business at a bank. Is there an easy button that those business owners can push to say, hey, local bank or credit union, I don't have a business license, but I have other documentation for my fisheries business or my alcohol business, so that they can start an account? in a timely way?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak directly to how in-depth it is to obtain a license as a bank or an insurance entity. Deputy Commissioner Fowler may be able to speak to that. I will tell you, I know that we do have some of these exempt businesses who have chosen to get a business license anyway. Many of our banks do have business licenses just because the nuances of state regulation elude many people, and it makes people feel better if they, a lot of people find their way to our business licensing database. And so finding your bank in there reassures people.
Please continue.
Thank you. The next few slides just give you a little bit of the sense of the scope of business licensing and endorsements. Here you can see numbers from 2014 through 2023. And you can see that these numbers reached a high point during the pandemic. And so you have here both the number of endorsements for selling tobacco, nicotine, and electronic smoking devices, as well as business licenses. You may be remembering that in the past we have talked about the fact that we have about 100,000 licensed businesses, and so I will move on to slide 7, where you can see...
Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Director Rob, to what do you ascribe the spike in number of business licenses during the pandemic, and now it seems to be falling, but what do you think caused that huge jump in 2021?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar. So there was a period of time during the pandemic. It began April 3rd in 2020 and went until February 1st of last year, where there was not a charge for a business license. That certainly may have been a contributing factor. Additionally, we certainly know during the pandemic, a lot of people found that their normal course of generating income was disrupted, and people took advantage of that, perhaps to, you know, give an entrepreneurial spirit a try. But we do not keep data on why people obtain a business license. So honestly, it's a little bit of speculation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Already ahead of myself. So here on slide 7, you can see both the new business licenses purchased, renewed business licenses, as well as current business licenses. And the way that you have a current business license is you can purchase a business license for 2 years if you choose. There is no monetary discount, but obviously then you don't have to go online and renew that each year. And that does bring the total to that roughly 100,000 number that we've spoken to the committee about before. Here on slide 8, you can see the business licenses and endorsements. So these are the number of businesses that have a tobacco endorsement, and then the darker bars are the number of actual endorsements. So a business may have a number of endorsements because you need to have an endorsement for each location where you sell nicotine products. And then here's the slide that's probably sort of the meat of this, which is the amount that is deposited into the general fund. So currently, the money that's generated through business license fees exceeds what it costs the division to operate that program, and the excess funds flow into the general fund. So the gray bars are the amount that's generated through business license purchases, and then the purple or blue is the amount that has lapsed into the general fund in the past. With that, we included the source of these if you're dying for additional business licensing statistics or a tobacco endorsement. You can do some research to satisfy your own curiosity. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to do the extremely short sectional or answer any questions.
Thank you, Madam Director. Are there any questions from committee members? I'm quite certain that we can forego the sectional. I think we understand the concept. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Seeing no other questions or discussion from committee members, we will set Senate Bill 203 aside for further consideration at another time. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. back on the record, it's 1:48 p.m. here in Belcher Room 105 at the Thomas Stewart Building. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will now take up Senate Bill 200, Turner's Contribution Rate per Social Security or SBS. To present the bill, we have the bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Bert Stedman, and his staff, Rose Foley, here with us. Please join us at the table, put yourselves on the record, and welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today, I'm pleased to present SB 200. I am the currently the senator dealing with and representing District A, which is all the islands in Southeast Alaska, plus a couple small communities on the mainland. Just didn't want to be inclusive of the folks on the mainland, like all of the senators sitting in front of me. So today, this is kind of the beginning of a discussion, and there's three options within this short bill that would like the committee to give some consideration to and some dialogue to as we work forward with other iterations of this piece of legislation. Clearly, this is not a finished product. They are substantially evolved concept plans, and we need to lay them on the table for consideration. So what, in essence, what this bill will do before we walk into the slides, it takes a look at the inequities within the retirement system, the current retirement system, for savings and accumulation of wealth to help you in retirement. And when we look at the teachers, our education system in the state, there's a lot of concern not only with the wage level, but with the savings for retirement. And when we compare a teacher, the average teacher, to the average state worker, there's a considerable discrepancy. And I think that leads to some concerns, and rightfully so, by the education system, that they should be accumulating more value towards your retirement, not just equal to the average state worker. And from my perspective as a citizen, and frankly as a senator for my region, I think they should be treated the same. I don't see a difference between an educator in a school system and an equipment truck driver for state DOT or an office worker in Anchorage or General. They're all our employees, and we need to try to take care of them. So in struggling with this concept, we came up with several areas. One of them, and we'll get into the details here in a minute, one of them was just a simple increase in the contribution to the retirement system, the current retirement system. Good, bad, or otherwise, leaving that discussion or off the table for now, the defined benefit versus the defined contribution, just a straight increase into the retirement system equal to what the average state worker has. The other area that we'll touch on would most likely exclude that, but what it would do is would allow all the educators to go into the supplemental benefit system. And for those watching at home, that's a replacement for Social Security. So the average state worker, not all of them, but the average state worker does not participate in Social Security while they're working for the state. They have an alternative program called supplemental benefit system, and the employee and employer equally contribute 6.13% of their salary to retirement. The teacher doesn't have that. So and we'll get into that here in a bit and why, but that would correct that, and it would allow them equal footing with all other employees in the state. And then the third branch of the bill would ask all employers that are not in Social Security and in SBS or SBS, and they are in the state's retirement system, a lot of municipalities, hospitals, all these non-state workers, that their employee is covered by either Social Security, SBS, or equivalent through some form of a bargaining agreement or what have you, employment agreement, so that employee is not shorted through his accumulation or her accumulation of wealth to retirement. Because there are employees around the state at the municipal level that are out of Social Security, out of SBS, and they have no replacement. And I just personally think that's unacceptable. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if I could, we could walk through some slides and then talk about some of these things. And we can start on the opening slide and jump to the second one. So here we have Teachers Retirement System, better known as TERS. And there are several folks within the legislature that are in this retirement system. So they probably understand some of the nuances better than some other folks. But the Teachers Retirement System was the first Alaska retirement system. It was developed by the Territory of Alaska in 1940 to encourage teachers to live and work in Alaska. And I think if we stop there just for a minute and we look back into the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the average teacher in Alaska had a substantial escalation over the average teacher in the southern 48 over their salary. I think there's a recent article or some work done by ICER on that very thing, and it's periodically in the papers. It's indisputable. Back in the 70s, teachers made a lot more money relative to their peers south in the 60s. Those days are behind us, and I don't think that is the case today. So just remember when we walk through this, when we look back at the retirement systems of yesteryear, the economic dynamics were different, why they were structured that way. They were reasonable at the time, and I will argue they're not reasonable in the current time. It's time we review this, take a look at it. So as time went on from the 40s, we went into Tier 1 and Tier 2, and they're defined benefit plans, and they were closed in June of 06. And for those watching at home, that means that the employee gets X percent, I think a teacher 65% after 30 years of their salary for as long as they live, regardless of war, pestilence, recessions, economic booms, makes no difference. Backed by the state, full faith and credit of the state of Alaska, backed up by the permanent fund and the full taxing authority of the state. No one's ever going to miss a check because there's not the adequate resources there. And they are today adequate resources there. In 06, we went to a defined contribution plan, which was a change in the structure. And rather than defining the benefit that you're going to get, it was defined as the contribution that went into the plan. It's a totally different animal. And and that's run on since 2006. So the teacher, the TERS employees, were neither in Social Security or SBS along this time. And if we go into a little history line along there, we take a look at that. You know, 1935, Social Security was established. That was a big deal back in the Depression. And then along came the teachers' retirement system in 1940. We should be very proud of that, that Alaska Territory was way out in front leading issues on retirement. And in 1950, the series of amendments to the Social Security Act allowed states and local governments to enroll employees in Social Security by enacting this Section 218 agreement. But now remember back in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, the average teacher's salary was substantially higher than they were south. So then along came PERS in 1961 and established the retirement system here for all employees who were also enrolled in Social Security. And then in 80, we opted out of Social Security, the state did, and created PERS. So the teachers did not opt into Social Security back in the 50s. They decided not to opt in. And when you think about it at the time, if their salary was as high relative to the folks south, you can see why there probably wasn't a lot of interest. They were amply compensated in retirement, and they had a defined benefit plan. They had a tier one defined benefit plan based off of their annual earnings and targeting 60% of their retirement or their employment income when they retire. Well, if you were 50% higher than the folks down south or 80% or some number, you're fine. But those times have changed, and now it's not like that. And we can see it throughout the articles of the last decade or so, where the employee or the salaries of teachers have come down to maybe they're 10% or 11% or some number higher than the national average. But they're not anywhere close to they were in 1970 or 60. So this slide here just kind of gives you a comparison for PERS, which is Public Employees Retirement Systems, Tier 4. So that's people that were employed with the state after 2006. So the employee contributes 8%, not the teacher, he's on the right-hand side. The employer kicks in 5%, and then this SBS, Supplemental Benefit System, the employer and the employee each kick in 6.12%. And that gives you a total of almost 25.24% of every paycheck going to retirement. If we glance over to the next column, you see where the teacher is. He's tier three or she's tier three. The employee puts in 8. The employer, in that case, puts in 7. And the reason there's a 5% for the PERS and 7% for TERS, when we put in the defined contribution plan, that 5% was increased by 2 percentage points because the teachers were not in PERS. SBS. Teachers were not in SBS. So they got a bump. So they ended up with a 15% contribution of all their salary on their retirement, both from the employer and employer. But the average state worker's at 25.25. Therein lies the inequity. And if they're going to save money for retirement, it doesn't matter if you're in a defined benefit or defined contribution, who wins that race at the end. You could never close that 10.24% gap. It's mathematically impossible. And when you look at that value of your SBS account, we'll hopefully get some information on that from the department over time. But it's not uncommon to see values of $750,000 to $1 million put away in the SBS account. And when you look at that amount of savings to retirement, it's significant. And that would be the delta between the current system and the funds available at retirement. So when you look at this and you ask yourself, well, how do you make it fair? Well, to me, fair is the employer, and we are the employer of the teachers and all the state workers. The employer should be contributing the same amount of money. What difference does it make if you're teaching school in Sitka, or you're working at the state airport in Sitka, or Kenai, or Anchorage, or anywhere else? They should be treated equally. So one concept in this plan, or this concept here, was to take that 7% contribution and say we did nothing else, but we added 2% to it. And that's what part of this bill is, and the fiscal notes written off of, which is will have to be adjusted by the Finance Committee when they start pulling and pushing all these levers here. Leave modest SBS and include a 2% increase or more to level out that contribution between the two. That's one lever. Or a 3% to make it even. But even a better one for the committee to consider is let the teachers in SBS have the employer pay 6.12%, just like they do to everybody else. The employee, can kick in 6.12%, like for everybody else. And then we would have to, when we pull that lever, we'd have to take that 7% down to make it So the total is 25.24. That would be the goal. What that would do, that would level the retirement system throughout the system. And when you're talking $750,000 for someone that works for 30 years, that is a significant amount of funds. And that those monies then in SBS are yours. If you pass away, they go to your family, whatever. They don't revert back to the state. So that's the crux of that.
Senator Merrick has a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Through the chair to Senator Stedman. Have you talked to the teachers about which of those two options they would prefer?
I've talked to the NEA representatives for the last couple of years about this concept, and they'd take all the money you'd give them with a smile and ask you the next breath for the defined benefit plan. But this moves the needle by the hundreds of thousands of dollars, not by tens of thousands. So I think the discussion as we move forward and do the analysis and get this on the table so they know it's a serious proposal will germinate that discussion.
Thank you.
So we'll go on to the next slide, and I should have financed, take a breath at the end of every slide, you know, for questions. But I think a little bit of this we already went through. And then some of the key provisions I touched on. Again, if we want to level the retirement system, we can do it in two basic ways for the teachers. One is just increase the state's contribution to equal all other state employees. And that would still leave them 6.12% short because their employee portion wouldn't exist. The preferred alternative would be to allow them to come into SBS, and the employer and the employee each contribute. We would then have that another fiscal lever to adjust, and that is the amount of monies that go to the increase from the employer perspective would have to come in through the top with a BSA increase and down to get those funds to the employees, which is a different subject on a BSA change than all the other BSA conversations we've had the last several months. This is just a pointed one to say, how do we fund it to get those monies to the employee? So those, and again, but it comes down to what lever does the legislature feel is best suited for the state and the employee. Do we want the state to just contribute what all other state workers get, or do we want to truly level the system? And I'd argue we need to really truly level the system. That way all of the employees are going to complain at the same level or cheer at the same level. Normally, if they're cheering, you don't hear much about it. But they'll all grouse at the same level. So this slide 7 is how the bill is written. And the bill is written in a combination of curing both things. Both things being one lever is just to move the employer contribution. The other lever being put them in SBS. So these numbers would have to be rearranged by the Finance Committee so that 27.24 would equal 25.24. And the employer contribution would be the same for the state employee as it would for the teacher. And then we would have to adjust again the BSA and how we fund it to ensure that there's truly balance and we're not sticking the added employer contribution to City Hall, because it comes down to basically their state responsibility for education. So that's the intent of the bill, Mr. Chairman. The other minor one that we didn't talk about much here, and that would be if we were to, which I think we should have a conversation about, require everybody to be in SBS or Social Security, and that is mainly targeted at some of the employers outside the state that are in a retirement system that are skating their obligation and not funding Social Security or SBS, and or replacing those monies with bargaining unit agreements, thereby leaving their employees short. And I can assure you, when we did the retirement rewrite in 2006, what I was very involved in, we had no intention, and it was just an oversight, we had no intention of allowing or interested in allowing an employer to not fund Social Security and not fund SBS, in short, the retirement system. Because this retirement system is balanced. The state's retirement system is balanced regardless if you're in a defined benefit or a defined contribution plan. It is balanced with a supplemental benefit system. It's about a quarter to a third of your retirement. And one without the other doesn't work. And what I'm bringing before consideration of this committee today is to try to get this dialogue started of let's level our retirement system out throughout the system. And if we can enhance the educators' retirement system by $750,000 over 30 years, so be it. If it's 800 or 900, they deserve every penny of it, just like all the other state workers. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm open for questions or crucifixion or whatever the chairman would like to do.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Are there questions from members of the committee? I have a couple questions.
Sure.
So when I look at this, a number that we didn't deal with in any of the slides is the number from section 1, 12.56 to 14.56. Mm-hmm. Could you tell the committee and for the record what number is that adjusting, and then how does that increase for the employer, how does that play with the other sections of the bill?
Okay, so let's take SBS and put that off the table now. So this would be the one lever. That was the first lever we were actually looking at in, when we're thinking of the concept of how to enhance a retirement system. And that was to move the TERS employees, have them get the same amount of contribution as the state workers from the employer, not the employee, but the employer, because the employer is getting, they're just less expensive when we figure in SBS. So we added 2% because that's in the mid-range. Actually, it should be a little bit higher than that to actually make it equal. So it'll trigger a physical note so we can see the cost. So that 12.56 is the normal cost. So what we did back years ago when we went from the defined benefit to defined contribution, we had to deal with TERS. And TERS is the fundamental obligation of the state, backed by the Constitution. So even though they work for the through the individual school systems, it's our responsibility. So we capped the contribution rate at 12.56% for City Hall, and the state picks up the balance. So if the unfunded liability went shot to the moon and we never saw it again and it just kept going up, 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 City Hall pays 12.56. We pick up the rest, we the state. So what this does is it would increase the state's contribution by 2% to enhance the teacher's retirement system. We probably would have modified that paragraph if we put them in social or if we put them in SBS, because I would think we'd want the numbers to match up with all the state employees, so that number would have to be adjusted. But that's what that is. It's one lever that leads them out of SBS but gets them more of a bigger contribution, because I think their contribution's too light. It's a 10% spread to accumulate wealth for retirement. And I'm not saying 25% is high or low. I'm just saying that's what it is for all the state workers, and I think the teacher should have the same.
Okay. So as I read the bill, it's not clear that this is a menu of options from section to section, but it's your intent that it be section one or section two or section three. How does all that work?
So section three is, that's the area that's targeted for the non-state workers, non-teachers. That might, that'll get some conversation with some of the communities. And we're still digging out how many communities will fall into that area. They're not necessarily collected. Or, yeah, the first section is TERS. Right, can we have a brief at ease?
Yep, brief at ease. Back on the record, it's 2:15 here in Belts Room 105. Question to Senator Stedman and staff. After all that, I have lost track of what the question was exactly, but we were discussing Section 3 and its impact as an option.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could have my trusty aide walk through the section, like I'd do a little sectional analysis. It might help. Maybe I probably was too enthusiastic given the committee's options to take. If they didn't like option A, we got option B. But go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Foley, please state your name for the record and please begin the sectional.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rose Foley, staff to Senator Stedman. I'll walk through this sectional here. It's a pretty brief bill, but section one covers the increase of 2%, and that deals with the cap that TERS employers contribute towards the normal cost and past service cost of the TERS plan. So with the 2% increase, it would raise the cap from 12.56 to 14.56% of payroll. Section 2 contains the 2% increase to the employer contribution in the TERS system, raising it from 7% to 9% of payroll. Section 3 is where we switch into the other lever, if you will, that's available to adjust retirement savings. Section 3 would require participation in either the state supplemental benefit system for any PERS and TERS employers that do not participate in Social Security. So if they already participate in Social Security, they're able to remain. If they participate in neither SBS nor Social Security, this would require them to enter Social Security. Section 4 adds employers within the TERS system to the definition of participating employer. For SBS, it currently is only PERS employers. So this would allow TERS to come into that supplemental savings. And Section 5 is the effective date.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Stedman, have you been able to identify aggregate and total cost to local municipalities and school districts based on what these two options would be?
For the school districts, the intent is to hold a district harmless. We'd have to increase the funding. than the employer side. The employee side, if we chose the option of putting the teachers in SBS, would be 6.13, like all other state workers. So the employee would have to contribute also.
So essentially what I heard you saying there is it would be a cut to what those employees see on their check, what their spendable cash is, and instead that 6% would go from their check into a mandated savings account for them.
Correct. But let's also remember then it's 100% matched by the employee, the employer. So just like when you put in your 6.13% into SBS, the employer matches it at 6.13%. So you get an instant 100% return. It is an impact to the net paycheck for the teacher because of that 6.13%. The intent of the bill, when we work through it for the employer, would be for the state to fund that addition. So it's no, the cost for a state employee is identical from the employer's perspective to the teacher. So we would have that adjustment also. And that, therein lies that what we're referring to is kind of option two, get him in SBS. The other option is we just leave him out of SBS and we, the employer, just make the same payment. But then the system, the retirement system, was set up to have SBS in it. So it still would leave them that 6.13% short of, they'd be at 19% savings for retirement instead of 25, a little over 25. So that would have to, I'm sure it'll, when we start looking at this, I'm sure it's going to generate some conversation because we're talking significant dollars here. We're not talking $10,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 of retirement. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars per individual after 30 years.
If I may, Mr. Chair, on total cost, we do not have a complete fiscal picture. We've received one fiscal note, but it appears to address only the change in the employer contribution and is silent on SBS.
Okay. Thank you. We continue to have conversations with the Alaska Municipal League as well as school districts around about impacts to them. I think the way many people are understanding this bill as it currently sits is that all sections would be enforced together and it's not as an or proposition. Mm-hmm. So that's one point of clarification that I think is important. The impact to school districts for teachers joining SBS statewide is well north of $100 million to the system overall. So that's a lot of money. There are other questions? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I received some documents from AML as well, trying to calculate those same kind of costs, but I want to make sure I understood right. So the whole harmless provision for the employee, the salary increase, is it envisioned that that would come from state funds or from that local government or school district?
So the
for the SBS,
the intent would be to hold the employer harmless, the school district harmless, not the employee. So the employee would, if we did SBS, the employee would have to kick in 6.13%. The employer, the school district, would have to kick in 6.13%. And we would have to fund that. Mm-hmm. We, the legislature, would have to fund that. We can't have the school districts eat that cost.
Okay. Yeah, this is interesting. This document is, again, I'm working off some numbers AML provided. It's labeled hold harmless salary increase. So to me, that sounds like something different you're describing.
Right, because what you're talking about there is a non-teacher. I assume in city hall, maybe they're a policeman or a fireman or whatever. Mm-hmm. City hall is, in that respect, if they don't have an SBS, they don't have a Social Security, and haven't covered Social Security within a bargaining agreement, then they're getting off they're getting off like skinflints, in my opinion.
So this, may I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So the total number here is the total increase as a result of SB 200 is $36 million. Have you seen that number, $36.3 million?
I don't have that document in front of me.
Okay. Well, I think we just received it today or perhaps yesterday. But you're saying that actually doesn't include some of the costs to the school districts.
I didn't look at the number. I don't know what you're looking at. I haven't seen that document.
I think
what that 36 is.
Senator Dunbar, it's something that we can discuss offline as we look at what the costs are and as we understand the bill and what the mechanics are, we can have accurate pictures of what the costs are and what they do.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it'd be easier if we worked with a CS with your office and clearly delineated option A, option B, option C, or whatever, because it wasn't very clearly delineated. We would not, the intent is not to overfund them over 25% to teachers, but to get them equal to everybody else. And they're significantly light, like 10% light. And I would grant Senator Dunbar's, you know, concern over the cost. It's expensive, but I think I would argue maybe it should have been there a long time ago.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess two questions. On SBS, is SBS like Social Security in that you are guaranteed until you pass away there'll be at least some form of benefit, or is it more like a 401k? You're shaking your head like it probably is. So I guess my question is, you know, we have heard testimony in this committee. I know you've heard it at finance too about the sort of the idea of sort of retirement failure, however you want to describe it. That is people running out of money before they pass away, essentially. Do you have any estimates on what the impact of this bill would be? Certainly, I think the intent is to reduce that number, you know, get it somewhere closer to zero. But do you have any sense of sort of what the scale of the reduction is? So we would go from X number of people experiencing retirement failure and running out of their savings to, with this bill, how many people do we think would still run out of savings before they pass away?
You'd have to ask an actuary that, Senator Dunbar, because if you put an extra $750,000 on the table and when they retire after 30 years of service, it's going to extend their retirement and probably their asset to their children substantially. It is not a defined benefit. It works just like a defined contribution. In fact, SBS is pretty much a defined contribution. It has the same portfolio selections as TERS has, or defined contribution plan, SBS, and defined, not defined, but the the delayed salary,
deferred
compensation. All have the same portfolio selection, all have the same returns. They're all basically the same thing. They're just different levers you can pull and push to get the money into the system. So will this help people that are going to run short of retirement? I would say yes, by far. And I would argue that this benefit of SBS then would be able to be, any residual balance would be able to go to your spouse and or your children when you die. So it's a significant, this isn't a little move of the needle. This is like reaching out and grabbing a hammer, yanking it back, and it's huge. All the other stuff we've talked about in here over the years have been little minuscule things moving. You can barely even measure them. In fact, we argue about the benefit at the end, right? Because it only moves a little bit. This thing moves it a lot. And if you work 15 years or 10 years, and you go off, take it with you. But we're willing to work with the chairman on making that kind of delineate some of this stuff and make it clear, because it does get complicated. There's no doubt about it. But it's a huge impact on our employees and their ability in retirement to stay in Alaska, live a fruitful life.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Through the chair to Senator Stedman. There's been talk around the building of a $680 BSA increase, and I realize we're short one fiscal note here, but I would like to see, you know, if that $680 is approved, how much of that would go to fund this versus classrooms and whatnot.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I've been trying to get physical notes on some of these concepts for well over a year. Everybody's backed up and lots of work and lots of things going on. But, just the basic question of for every 1% additional contribution for a teacher in retirement, what's it cost the state? And then we can just take the 1% and say we got to give them 4, we got to give them 3. We can have that discussion, but we need the number. And then the SBS, we know it's 6.13. So what if it's 6.13, what does it cost us? And what's it cost the employee? But it would, and then, later on, if we decide to go down this route, we got to figure out how we're going to afford it, how we're going to phase into it, or what are we going to do? But when you look at a teacher saving 15% for his or her retirement versus a state worker at 25, there's just no way. It's impossible. We've got to close the gap, and it might take us a few steps to get there.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman.
Any other questions or committee discussion? Seeing none, Senator Stedman, Ms. Foley, thank you. We will set this bill aside for further consideration at a future meeting, and we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for our next bill. Back on the record is 235 in Belts Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building. Next, the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will take up Senate Bill 153, Overtime Pay Exemption. With us to make a brief presentation on the bill, we have Commissioner-Designee Kathy Munoz of the Department of Labor. Commissioner-Designee, thank you for joining us today. Please put yourself on the record and welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Munoz, Commissioner Designee for the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I will make introductory remarks for SB 153, an overtime pay exemption bill. And then on the teams here with us today is Jeremy Applegate, the chief of the State of Alaska's Wage and Hour Division. And Jeremy will walk us through a presentation on wage and hour law and then be available for questions on SB 153. So the purpose of SB 153 is to add a section to Alaska Statute 2310060, creating an exemption from overtime pay for full-time employees working a flexible work schedule for up to 12 hours per day, 3 days per week. Eligible entities include ambulatory surgical centers, child placement agencies, foster homes, birth centers, hospices, nursing facilities, residential child care facilities, and residential psychiatric treatment centers. Under statutory authority, overtime pay applies to work performed over 40 hours a week, 40 hours in 1 week, or 8 hours in 1 day. State law currently provides an exemption of state overtime requirements in flexible work schedules of 4-10s, that is to say 10 hours per day for 4 days a week. These are voluntary agreements entered into a voluntary agreement between the employer and the employee, and a written signed document is presented to the Department of Labor to authorize these agreements. SB 153 would add an additional flexible work schedule of 12 threes, that is 12 hours a day, 3 days a week, giving employers a new recruitment tool and prospective employees the opportunity to enjoy longer periods of downtime during the week. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Chief Jeremy Applegate of the Wage and Hour Division to present more information on SB 153 and to take questions of the committee. Thank you.
Mr. Applegate, please state your name and location for the record and begin your presentation. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jeremy Applegate, Investigator 5, Chief of Wage and Hour for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I am speaking to you today from my office here in Anchorage. Next slide. One slide back. I'm sorry. There we are. Okay. It's blurry here. So yes, the purpose of my presentation today here is to add a bit of context to what the commissioner just presented to you. The purpose of this bill is to essentially expand the flex plan availability from a 410 plan availability that is currently on the books to a 12-hour-a-day plan for 3 days. For the covered entities that are identified here, those entities fall under or are defined by Alaska Statute 47.32.010. Next slide, please. So overtime currently in the state of Alaska, as the commissioner has stated, is anything over 8 hours in a day and over 40 hours in a work week. Now, Alaska is a dual overtime state, meaning that we do have the daily overtime and the weekly overtime, whereas at the federal level, the overtime is only based on the week. So this is an exemption that applies to the daily overtime in the state of Alaska. It would not be an exemption from the over 40 requirement, as state law would not be able to override the federal requirement of everything over 40. And, of course, overtime is defined by Alaska Statute 10.060. Next slide, please. The applicability of overtime extends to all employees in the state of Alaska that are not otherwise exempt. This flex plan provides essentially for a partial exemption from overtime, not a complete exemption from overtime, as you will find for other areas of employment under Alaska law. Next slide, please. So the current flex plan framework allows employees to work up to 10 hours a day without overtime if the employee voluntarily enters into one of those plans. As the commissioner stated, when a employer would like to potentially implement a flex plan through their office or in their place of business, they would submit a flex plan on an approved form to our office for review. If the hours that are requested in the plan requested falls within the scope of what the law requires, we approve those plans and send them back to the employer. The employer then presents that to the employee, asks if the employee would like to voluntarily enter into that arrangement. If the employee would like to enter into that arrangement, the employee then signs on, and the employer can hold them in that arrangement unless the employee opts out from November 1st through December 31st, the standard opt-out period in each year. The employer can allow the employee to opt out at any time. However, the standard opt-out period is from November 1st through December 31st of each year, where the employee has the option to opt out through their own volition. And if the employee works outside of these plans, the employee is owed overtime. Now, the position of the department or the enforcement position of the department has been that if the employee works beyond the plan and that is incidental to employment, as the law requires, the employee is to be paid overtime. If the employer takes the flex plan and then schedules the employee beyond the 10 hours, up to 10 hours in a day allowed by the plan, that is not incidental to employment, and the agreement, the flex plan agreement, would be considered invalid, and the employer would have to go back and pay overtime for all hours worked under the plan in excess of 8 hours in a day. And that would be paid at the premium rate of 1.5 times the rate of pay, otherwise, again, known as overtime. Next slide, please. So, in summary, this is a partial exemption from the plan. I'm sorry, partial exemption from overtime for daily overtime that would allow these employees of these specific entities to work up to 12 hours a day in a 3-day time period, whereas the standard framework is 4 10-hour days for all businesses in the state of Alaska that have an approved flex plan. The overtime would have to be paid for any employee working over the approved plan or outside the approved plan or anything over 12 hours in a day. And these remain voluntarily on the behalf of the employee. They cannot be made a condition of employment. And it only applies to those businesses that are licensed under 47.32.010B. And with that, if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to address them.
Senator Merrick has a question, and then Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Thank you, Mr. Applegate. Can you give me the reason that you're limiting this to the businesses listed in 47.32.010 and not giving all employers the option to offer this for their employees?
I believe that these were the businesses or the industry that was asking specifically for this change. And it would, from anecdotal evidence with my conversations with those in this industry, their need stems from standard practices in the medical industry of shift changes, where they're generally trying to keep all staff on a similar shift change schedule for the purposes of continuity of care and good communication. It could obviously be expanded to all businesses in the state of Alaska. There's no reason that it couldn't. And, of course, the discretion of the legislature.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bjorkman.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, and the second one is similar to what Senator Merrick just said. But I guess I'm curious about enforcement and what you said about it cannot be a condition of employment. I imagine during the interview process, when they're hiring new employees, how do you enforce that? How do you prevent the employer from saying, you know, we work 312s here, we work 410s here. Is that a schedule you'd like to work, you know? And then the person says no, and they just don't hire them. How do you prevent the employer from doing that?
Through the chair, there is no essential way to prevent that. We are an evidence-based finder of fact agency. Much like all law enforcement, once a violation has occurred, we would go back and look for evidence of that violation if it exists, and then take enforcement action accordingly. But if it is not brought to our attention, or if the violation can't be demonstrated to have occurred, of course, there would be no enforcement action.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
So it occurs to me, you know, I was thinking back to my time working in the cannery and how much overtime I worked, but I didn't have a good understanding, partly because I was young, of what the overtime rules were. And it occurs to me that a lot of people interviewing for these positions probably don't know that this part of statute exists. So I guess I'm sort of skeptical they know that when they're hired and their employer says you can get 410s or 312s, that they're actually entitled to overtime for those extra hours unless they've signed one of these, right? And their employer can't deny them hire because they refuse to sign one of these and forego overtime. But you have no way to enforce that, right? I mean, how many folks do you have? How many people do you have in your enforcement division that can proactively go out and you know, check on employers that are doing this? Do you ever have people go through the hiring process, you know, and sort of test it that way?
Through the chair, no, we do not engage in that type of activity. They are brought to us through a wage claim process. To address the question of how the employee might know what their rights are, at the time that the employee is presented with one of these plans, knowing that the employee cannot work under one of these schedules without having signed off on one of those plans, the form that they would be signing does include all of those statutes and regulations associated with the plan, and a breakdown of what is required of the employee and employer under the plan. So if they would take the time to read the plan, they would see that, one, it is voluntary, and two, what the requirements of the plan would be before signing.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I think that sort of gives me some pause when we're talking about if we wanted to massively expand this program, right? Because this is a very specific and relatively sophisticated industry where you've got professionals that are in high demand. And if there were abusive labor practices, I think that someone working at an ambulatory surgical center probably sort of can get hired at a less abusive employer. You know, I'm not sure that's the case in every industry. But I will say, in terms of folks that want to join this kind of program, I was curious, under 4732.010 Bravo, I had someone today, actually, I believe it's the position of the Municipality of Anchorage, actually, that they want this expanded to behavioral health providers. But looking at the list that you provide us, it includes residential psychiatric treatment centers and subacute mental health facilities. So this might not be a question for you, Mr. Applegate, but are there any behavioral health providers that aren't included in this program?
Through the chair, I honestly would have to look at the matter much closer and see what does or does not fit within the scope of those entities listed as far as how behavioral health centers would be licensed and whether or not they would fit within that, those defined categories.
So maybe that could be a question for the broader department before we come back for our next hearing. Drug treatment facilities, for example, where you have to monitor people around the clock, and so you need 2 12-hour shifts at least, you know, and probably some overlap too. That seems like a logical place to do this kind of thing. And so if there aren't any behavioral health providers or drug treatment providers included here, and we should reach out to the health association and make sure it's something they want. But if it is, I think that would be a group of providers that I think might benefit from this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Any further committee discussion?
Okay. I have one, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the department, for Commissioner Designee, have you spoken with the, I guess my question is sort of in general, how does the labor community feel about this? And how do the employees feel about this? And has there been any discussion with any of the relevant either bargaining units or groups, associations that are not in bargaining units about this change?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, this issue first came to the department's attention, I believe, a year ago, and it was first brought to us by individuals involved with ambulatory surgical centers as a means to boost recruitment opportunities. We heard that employers in that particular industry find that, you know, with labor shortages, that they're needing to create more incentives. And this would be seen as a recruitment incentive if, again, done on a voluntary basis with the approval of the participating employee. But beyond that, you know, I can't say that we've had expansive discussions with other employers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. You mean employees?
I'm sorry, employees or employers. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any closing comments, Commissioner Designee?
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. We will get the additional information on the behavioral health providers and trying to, putting together a list of providers that could possibly be incorporated into the legislation. And we'll get that information back to the committee.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions or committee discussion, we'll set this bill, Senate Bill 153, aside for further consideration at a future meeting. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday, March 27th, when we will hear three bills. First up will be Senate Bill 239, Aid to Workforce Housing Development, Senate Bill 257, Electric Utility Regulation, and Senate Bill 154, Bidder Preference Military Career Skills Program. As there is no further business before the committee today, this meeting is adjourned at 2:54 p.m.